Thank you all for joining me again. This is the Jaguar Shaman. You're tuning into episode 23 of Ascension Radio. I have a very special guest with me today. This is a person that I was fortunate enough to follow on Twitter. He is a great writer. He has many, many things going on right now. This is Garrett. You can follow him on Twitter at Libera Rex. It's at LIBERA_REX. Garrett, if you'd like to introduce yourself to the audience, speak a little bit about, you know, one of the kind of projects that I've seen that you've been developing and it's been growing, Ion Media.
Yeah, definitely. First, I want to say thank you for having me. It's an honor to be on here.
Of course, my brother.
So Ion Media originally, it's kind of funny how it started. Originally, it was just going to be me doing graphic design for people. And somehow, in the midst of what was going on Twitter at the end of October, I ended up with a group of dudes, and now we're making a full-blown media company. So our tagline is Nourishment for the Human Spirit. The premise is that we're going to be like a standard media outlet, you know, like a news company, but we're not going to touch politics, and we're going to try and create the kind of content that I think, you know, Jordan Peterson's a good example of he opened a market up.
Yeah.
Then there's this huge market for that kind of like deep philosophical, psychology styled discussions about mythology, religion, science, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So that's really what we're going for, is to build on what they've been building.
And that's awesome, man. That's awesome. And I think that, you know, what you just said, you know, that your tagline or kind of your, you know, goal or calling is that the nourishment for the human, you know, the spirit. I think that's very, very big, because I think we can all agree that the media nowadays is almost the opposite of that. It's almost like toxicity for the human spirit, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, man. So I think that that's amazing. I think that, you know, you've definitely, you know, caught my eye. I know that you've caught the eyes of several other people on Twitter, who are kind of under the same umbrella, you know, and I think that what you've been doing, particularly, and I do want to say this because I, you know, I give props where props are due. I think you're one of the best writers that I've come across on Twitter, you know, not just about, you know, the writings that you've written on certain spiritual subjects, but across the board. You know, is writing a hobby for you? Was that kind of something that was a calling, or was it just something you just kind of did, you know, for enjoyment?
Well, thank you for saying that. So it's interesting. When I was in school, I really, really didn't like writing.
Right.
When I was a kid growing up, I didn't enjoy it. I was good at it. I just didn't like it. Mm-hmm. And when I went to college, my time in college was not generally spent in class. But there was one class I had the last semester I was there that was a creative writing class. And that was the only class that I showed up to every day, even though I was getting ready to drop out. And somehow during that, I kind of, you know, it was cool because my teacher literally said, you can do whatever you want and you'll get an A as long as you put in effort. Right. So I had the freedom to actually write about stuff that I liked writing about.
Right.
And from there, I had determined a long time ago that I was going to write two major books in my life. The ones that I've written so far don't count. And I figured, well, if I'm going to write like a full length philosophy book, then I better start writing and get ready for that.
Right.
And that's where my website came from.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And so that was kind of, you know, you were, and I definitely agree with the sentiment you expressed about, you know, not having to write earlier on in my early years. But I feel like, you know, it's different when people tell you what you have to write about than when you get to write what you like to write about, you know?
Yeah, definitely. School, the way the school system is set up, it almost completely destroys all creativity, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's very interesting that you touch on the subject of creativity, because as somebody who studies shamanism and who has practiced shamanism, you know, one of the biggest things that I have to cultivate in people in my classes when I kind of, you know, introduce them to shamanic journeying is the concept of recultivating your creativity and really, you know, getting in tune with that creative self that we all have inside, that oftentimes is written off as, well, I'm not an artist, so why should I be creative? Or I don't make music, so why should I be creative? You know, creative expression is quite literally a representation of the creative kind of energy that you know brought us all to be. And so, you know, in my opinion, it's definitely a divine right that everybody should, you know, cultivate within themselves.
Yeah, definitely. I think I even would go so far as to say that if you're a man and you're not exercising the creative capacity, you're not going to be fulfilled.
Absolutely.
It definitely, that was, writing became my outlet. I used to make music, and now I taught myself guitar more for fun. So I don't really like write on guitar. I just play it, mm-hmm. but writing itself became my outlet. And that's probably been the most, like the largest improvement in my quality of life, having started doing something creative.
And that's awesome, man. That's awesome. And I agree with you 100%. I think that, you know, if you look at like, for example, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? You know, there is a need, you know, obviously to fulfill yourself with the lower needs of you know, having, you know, a roof over your head and, you know, being able to put food on the table and having clean drinking water and, you know, kind of the basics. But as you go up that pyramid, that leads to, you know, hypothetically leads to self-actualization. There is a requirement to kind of elevate yourself to these more creative, you know, driving forces that we have within us. You know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of people that say that you know, the channeled sexual energy is creative energy. And so a lot of these people that, you know, that are addicted, let's say, to pornography or to sex, what they're really looking for is an outlet for that creative force that pushes people and they're just misappropriating it into the traps that society kind of lays for. You know, it's for everybody, but I'd say that men get barraged very heavily with draining their creative energy on pointless things.
Yeah, that, well, that's, I mean, think about so much of the structure of society is built around controlling that force, the masculine generative force, right. You know, mm-hmm. If you look at the, like, young girls are far better off in school environments because it's so much more catered to the calm, nurturing, as opposed to the kind of chaotic, destructive force of like young men.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, we're kind of in a society, you know, I'm very careful to touch on these subjects of like masculinity, femininity, but, you know, I think that it's something that needs to be noted because I do feel that right now there's almost like a void for young men growing up. You know, part of it is, how do I express myself as a man without coming off, you know, misogynistic or being labeled as this kind of woman hater. But at the same time, you know, how do I express myself, you know, in an environment where, you know, us men kind of take care of making sure that we're conditioned as well. You know, we kind of perpetuate these things for men. And I think that you know, the way that the world is set up right now, particularly schooling, I do think that it makes it so that, you know, young men are kind of being declawed or taken, you know, they're almost kind of forcing them into this bubble. And I think that, to be fair, I think this is a bubble that women have been forced into for years.
Yes, you know, definitely.
But it's now kind of splitting and taking over both. And it's almost like it's lulling people to sleep through confusion, you know, as if it wasn't confusing enough to kind of find yourself in this world. Now you're being told by society that the expressions of masculinity that you feel so naturally might be toxic. You know, and while I do agree that there is a certain level of toxic masculinity that is pervasive in especially American society, but I want to say globally, mm-hmm. I think that has just kind of been as a result of, you know, a patriarchy that has kind of grown out of control, and has kind of, you know, it's requiring a balance. And I think that we're coming into an age where we're seeing kind of both polar sides moving towards the middle, and that's why we see so much chaos right now, because it's kind of that stabilization is occurring, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's I definitely think part of the significant issue that we can see, and again, Peterson's a great example of this, we have such a problem with lacking positive masculine role models across the board.
Absolutely.
You know, there's if you think about who are kids supposed to look up to, you have like the Fast and Furious movies, which is just like massive dudes on steroids that just kill. And that's their entire character. That's the whole premise of the movie. Mm-hmm. You have like rappers who just sing about doing drugs, and you have, you know, rock singers that just sing about doing drugs, and athletes who aren't, you know, terribly educated people. They're not necessarily good at doing anything except playing a sport. So you have this really, you don't have a great abundance of like fully actualized men.
Yes.
And this is, I think, going to be a good time for us to see actualized women, because society seems to be leaning towards that.
Yep.
But at present, it seems to be unbalanced in such a way where we're doing that at the expense of actualizing men.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, we, you know, to take a lesson, let's say, from kind of, you know, hermeticism and, you know, bring it forward to the kind of a spiritual undertone of it. There's definitely, you know, the way that I see the universe, it kind of works in opposites until it kind of gets to the point where it needs to be. So it's kind of like a pinball hitting, you know, two bumpers till it slows down, and then it kind of hits the middle. You know, you kind of see that with the phi ratio, like all these things are trying to reach phi, but they're never actually reaching it. They're just, you know, kind of spiraling towards that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's what we're seeing. And I think that if it were naturally left alone with no media influence and with no kind of weaponization of these ideals, I think it would be a much more kind of fluid, you know, kind of, I don't want to say a conclusion because it never really concludes, but a transition, you know? And I think what we're seeing in the media is definitely now that women are able to, you know, find places in the workplace where they're appreciated, where they're being kind of let, like you said, that they're being allowed to actualize themselves within careers, within their life. I think the media is using that and kind of trying to drive a wedge between men and women so that it seems that you cannot have a self-actualized woman and a self-actualized man at the same time.
Yeah, and I think that plays to a naive point of view. I think part of the issue, I would say part of the issue is that in especially American culture, and I'm not as familiar with other cultures, obviously, so I won't speak for them, the major problem I see is that just as we don't have a actualized male role model, like we don't have a concept of what the correct modern man is.
Right.
And I think a lot of that is the same for women, especially for women, considering at least historically we've had significant masculine figures that we can emulate.
Right.
Whereas historically they don't really cover that kind of stuff. And I know feminism talks a lot about that, and a lot of very valid points that really the men probably aren't going to address and shouldn't be addressing.
Right.
And that's kind of where we're at. That's the problem. Yep. Is okay, well, where the men are going to have to figure out their own philosophy, the women are going to have to figure out their own philosophy, and it's going to have to be in such a way that they're harmonious.
Right.
You know, and that's the difficulty.
Right. And this is kind of where I get into it with a lot of you know, Twitter that talks about the divine feminine and the divine masculine energies. You know, I know that you wrote an article about how instead of the divine feminine, you know, we should be talking about the divine mother, the divine goddess, and how kind of even that wording is important. One of the issues that I see is that, you know, there's this push towards androgyny, right? And androgyny in itself isn't a bad thing. The problem is that if you had, like you said, if we don't have defined things of what it means to be an actualized man or woman, how can we then, you know, claim to have a defined mix of the two or a defined healthy mix of the two, you know?
Yeah, that's a great point.
You get what I'm saying? And so mm-hmm. we haven't kind of stabilized the polar opposites, and somehow we're trying to force a middle ground that can't really occur until those two opposite forces, you know, are stabilized. And you know, you made a great point. I think that, you know, that whole role model issue is that because we don't have these, you know, role models as men. I mean, I remember myself growing up, I used to love action movies, man. You know, the I'm talking about Rambo, Terminator, you know, Jean-Claude Van Damme. I mean, these are all, you know, kind of the you know, badass kind of hero archetypes that kind of, you know, their take on women wasn't always the most positive. And so, you know, we grow up emulating those things. And I think that that's, you know, one of the things that we're seeing. And the same thing with women. I mean, you know, women's role models were always kind of, hey, listen, you know, you need to be meek, you need to be quiet, you need to hear when the men speak. And now you have all these women, you know, like that are coming forward that are, you know, role models, that they're really actualizing themselves. And so, you know, even though they didn't have somebody to maybe look up to, I mean, maybe they could have had a couple. The first one that comes to mind is Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But, you know, we as men really don't have that other than kind of through the media, through entertainment. I mean, who I don't look up to anybody in politics as a you know, as a man. I can't say that any of them kind of embody a divine, you know, masculine or what a man should be. I think in the news, I mean, you know, we don't really have that, like you said. And so I agree that that's definitely a good point of conversation there in terms of how can we kind of as the new generation coming up, establish a philosophy of what it means to be a man in this modern world. Because even looking at the ancients, we can't just resuscitate ancient beliefs and think that they're going to apply fully in the modern era. You know, it just doesn't work. And so I think it'll be interesting for us to kind of keep an ear on the ground in terms of how this plays out and how this kind of, you know, issue between, I don't want to call it a gender war because I think that that's been going on for forever, but kind of the discrepancies that we're seeing coming up a lot with the younger generations in terms of the kind of like this reach for power. I think it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. So there's one point that I'm curious to get your perspective on.
Yeah, sure.
There's a series of articles I wrote. There was actually a huge gap between the two of them because I couldn't figure out exactly the right conclusion until I think December when I wrote the second one.
Gotcha.
So it's around the idea of the syzygy, you know, the divine androgyne. And so the most of culture seems to be centered around that myth. Whereas, you know, what the Hermetic maxim is, if you make the masculine like the feminine and the feminine like the masculine, and the above like the below, and your two eyes are one, then you'll enter the kingdom of heaven, right? So the problem that I found with this, and this took me a really long, this is fairly surprising to consider. It seems like the androgyne isn't the goal.
Yeah.
The androgyne is a means to the end. So you have to, I guess what I, like if we look really macro at culture, I see what we've been doing in the past 100 years or so. The feminine has become more masculine, the masculine has become more feminine, because before that time in history, neither side understood each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now we're at this point where we're fairly blended. I'd say there's a lot more androgyny in men and women today than 100 years ago.
Absolutely.
But I think what is required is not simply to achieve this state of androgyny, but to go past that and return with the knowledge to become a completed man or woman, you know, to reassume the role knowing what it entails,
right,
instead of just doing it unconsciously.
Right. And yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there's certain principles, you know, kind of with Hermeticism where I part. And one of those is the kind of concept of an incomplete person. That you somehow need kind of that if you're a man, that you need to exhibit feminine qualities or embrace this feminine perspective in order to be complete, and vice versa, that a woman needs to embrace a masculine perspective. I think that that's been kind of misconstrued a lot by a lot of scholars into being taken literally. And I think that anybody who knows, you know, kind of esoteric belief systems, the last thing that you really want to do is take things literally, because that's kind of the point of why they wrote it the way they wrote it, is to mask a lot. And so my perspective on that is, I think that the same way, you know, that when you kind of go through this spiritual awakening, that you realize that all things are one.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's more kind of the way that I understand that whole, you know, as above, so below, the male and the female energies. I think that, you know, as you said, we need to take them into consideration and understand that they are a part of us. But at the same time, your personality does not need to embody that.
You know, right.
What I'm saying? As long as within your subconscious, you are aware of those things and you kind of bring them to conscious, it doesn't mean that you need to implement them into your life. That doesn't mean that you need to dress up like Prince, and like Prince, you know? It's just almost like a reconciliation of that knowledge. And that's one of the things, you know, interestingly enough, that the Andean shamanistic perspective looks at when it thinks about the quote unquote archetypal hero's journey, where we're descending into the lower realms in order to be able to clear our path to the higher realms. When you go into the lower realms, it's really kind of an understanding that what you're tapping into is either your subconscious or the collective subconscious. When you go down there, there are things that you're going to face that doesn't necessarily mean you need to hold on to. But there are things down there that you need to face that you do need to hold on to. And I think that when they talk about the reconciliation of the masculine in the female, or the or the or the feminine in the male, or the goddess and the god within both, I think it's more understanding the principles of your subconscious that may be leaning towards that, and then choosing what ways they're going to manifest as a personality in this world. Because remember, our higher self and our personality are two completely different things, right? Mm-hmm. Our personality is almost the mask that we have to wear in this existence. And I don't want to use the term mask as in like that you hide things from people, but it's almost kind of like if the soul were the computer, personality would be the operating system, you know, Mac or Microsoft, you know, and how it expresses itself. And so, you know, we definitely do need to kind of reconcile those energies. For example, if I understand that you know, I have a problem showing compassion, that may be a lack of certain subconscious blocks, or it may be the presence of certain subconscious blocks that haven't allowed me to reconcile that energy that people would, you know, say is a feminine quality, compassion. And even with me saying that, think about how weird that sounds, that compassion is a feminine quality. Like, no, men can be compassionate as well. And that's why I split very much from like, so you're saying that somebody who's compassionate is exhibiting these qualities, and if they're not, then they're lacking them. We all have them. It's just a reconciliation of those things. And I think I actually saw you on Twitter talking about something similar in terms of, you know, you can have these things present. You can have a philosophy of it, because that philosophy is what drives your actions, you know? Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about that philosophy is that your philosophy is normally aligned with values that you hold. And so you can change your values at any time in your life if you realistically really wanted to think about it. I mean, it's just a matter of, you know, what your actions drive that create kind of the habits, and then your habits create your values, and then your values create you, you know?
Right.
I think it's like you said, it's about really kind of understanding those, you know, kind of certain sides of you, you know, that certain people aren't as compassionate in nature. You know, that doesn't mean that they don't exhibit, you know, certain other feminine qualities, or that they haven't reconciled the feminine. It just means that in their expression through their personality, those things aren't present. You know, I think more attention should be paid to the inner work that needs to be done to reconcile those differences, because, you know, there's a difference between somebody who's truly just not compassionate to a certain degree, and somebody who's not compassionate because, let's say, they fear attachment, or they fear certain things. You know, anything really based off of fear is a block to your true self.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think part of the issue, too, could be that I guess a great example of this would be people, let's say men, ideally this is going to be men, mm-hmm. who are striving to avoid being compassionate so that they feel like they'll be recognized as men more.
Exactly.
That would be exactly where I'd see the problem.
Exactly. And that's a fear-based belief right there, you know?
Bingo. Yeah. It's interesting. And the one thing I wanted to touch on that you mentioned, you said the mask and the soul. The words that I use in my terminology, that would be the mask, or the ego proper, the right. personality, the thing that mediates the soul. And the soul would be the true self. So pure consciousness, the clear light, or the divine spark, whatever you know. But yeah, no, that's I think most people seem to be so stuck in playing a part, mm-hmm. that they don't analyze the person playing the part.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. And you know, it's funny, because the more kind of discrepancies that there are between your true self and that mask, the harder it is to really return to your true self. And that's where people, you know, will sit there and have these midlife crises kind of mm-hmm. later in life, because they realize that they've fabricated a lie, that they've put all this energy into this lie. And the truth is, the more that you feed that shadow behind the mask, the harder it is to get rid of a lot of those things that really aren't you. Because, you know, the goal is never to get rid of the shadow. The goal is to get rid of the kind of inflations of certain aspects of you that the shadow has fed into, that have created right. this discrepancy. You know, ideally, you know, we want to be and kind of reach or strive to be, you know, as connected to our higher self as we can. And, you know, a lot of people use the term higher self as if it's this entity that's disconnected from you, kind of watching from above. I think the higher self is very much with you at all times. It's just, you know, it's up to you to let it speak. It's up to you to listen and then allow it to express itself. And the more that you do that, the more that you see this mask of the personality that we wear become like the higher self, you know? It's it's the whole thing with kind of don't kill your ego, master it.
Yeah, 100%. I'm really big on that. That was one of my major issues with some of the Eastern philosophies is I spent years in the process of trying to kill my ego. Right. And it takes, I mean, that's such a miserable process. Agreed. Because it's mental suicide. That what it comes down to, the desire to get rid of the ego is the desire to die.
Yeah.
Because you can't live without the ego, but you can understand that there's, you know, and this is why I distinguish between the petty ego, which is thoughts, ideas, feelings, beliefs, opinions.
Right.
And the ego proper, which is your personality, your experiences, and things that can never change. Exactly. You can add to your ego proper, but it doesn't change over time. It just grows.
Right. Right.
And so that's a way where you can keep like the Western concept, the Freudian concept of the ego, but you can try and get rid of the Eastern concept, which is the petty ego, all the attachment to those things that you think are used. Like so many people think they're thoughts.
Right.
They think, oh, the thoughts are me. So if you attack their belief or you attack their opinion, they get offended because they can't tell the difference.
Exactly. And
it feels like a personal attack, you know?
And that's why it's so dangerous, man, because, you know, we live in the information age, but we also live in the disinformation age at the same time. You know, we have all this access to so many things. And it's funny you mentioned that. One of the main reasons why I started this podcast was because in my exploration of all these different paths of spirituality, because, you know, I consider myself kind of a connoisseur of those things, of those ideologies. While I have my own kind of spiritual path and ideology, I love to hear about all different types of it. And one of the reasons I did that is because, you know, oftentimes people get into something like Buddhism, or they'll get into something like yoga. And, you know, there's so much misinformation about these paths that is kind of just sold off as truth. And it's very hard. Like, for example, like you said, for some people, you know, they understood the hidden meaning of what it meant to kill the ego. I mean, you know, but people like you and I took it literally. I really did when I first started, you know, same thing. I was having such a hard time because I'm like, okay, well, how do I know what's this kind of ego and what's really me? And I would meditate and I would sit there and it just wasn't working. And it wasn't until I heard somebody speak about, you know, listen, don't kill your ego, master it, that it all made sense. That I understood, like, it's not about killing that, because without the ego, you would be susceptible to just be programmed. If you don't have an ego, that means you don't have any personal boundaries around yourself that create who you are. And although, yes, there's a certain reach through a lot of spiritual philosophies to become one, it's not the whole point, okay? That the whole point is not to understand that everything is one. I mean, if that was the case, any kid who popped an acid tab in college would be considered spiritually enlightened, right? That's one of the first things that acid does to you, is that like, oh my God, like everything and I is connected. Like, it's deeper than that. It's taking that and then understanding that you also are an individual representation of consciousness in this reality that was given certain things that others don't have, and those tools were given to you so that you could self-actualize with those tools, you know, not so that you could give them up and say, no, this ego is horrible. We'll figure out why and master it and keep those things that are important for your path, you know?
Yeah. No, that's really well said. I think it's interesting if you think about, I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions overall, the whole kill your ego thing.
Yep.
What I have to imagine that there's some degree of mistranslation that went on to cause that, or just misunderstanding over time. You know, if you think about most of the spiritual traditions over time have been passed down through master disciple lineages.
Mm-hmm.
And there's basically no guarantee that if, let's say I'm a 100% enlightened master and I have 10 students and 8 of them don't understand what's going on. One of them has a pretty good idea And one of them is 90% there. He's got almost everything.
Right.
You know, if you think about that over time, if that's the case, each time you lose so much information and, you know, a couple hundred years of lineage go by and you've lost the meaning. You've lost the course, the core framework behind the imagery and the mythology.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I agree 100%. And I think just to touch on a point you made there, because it's actually one of the things that is one of my pet peeves, is the fact that, you know, everything that we say and everything that we give out, whether it's 100% true, is being given out through a filter of our perception. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so inherently, anytime we trade information, it's being, I don't want to use the word tainted, but it's being transformed through our perspective. And then also through the listening of whoever's taking in that information, it's being transformed again, you know? So from the pure idea transferred on to somebody else, that pure idea is taking on two transformations. It's taking on the transformation of the teacher, and then it's taking the transformation of the listener who's understanding, you know, these systems. Absolutely. I think that it's definitely, you know, been passed down and it's just been misinterpreted, you know, because when you look at, for example, some of the philosophies of, like, you know, really ancient, you know, one of the things with them was, you know, don't kill your ego, but really be a good person, you know, strive to be that, you know, the reason why they say one should be in a meditative pose or a meditative mindset for most of their life is because you should always be aware of your intent and of what the effects of your actions will be. And if you're always kind of watchful of that doesn't mean obsess over it, but if you're watchful of that, you'll see that your intuition will always guide you to do the right thing. And I don't mean that in a morally objective way, but I mean that in a way that you know your soul is doing what it needed to do. You know, when you walk away from that, that's where guilt kicks in. You know, when you start doing things that you know you shouldn't be doing, that's where guilt comes in, and you start feeling that kind of, wow, like, I really shouldn't have done that. That probably wasn't the smartest thing. When you look at it from an Eastern perspective, as we were touching on before, it's almost like they just want people stuck in this, like, nirvana of bliss at all times and kind of forget about the realities of life. We're still very much alive, and to be alive, you require an ego. You know, that's just the truth about it. I mean, you don't want the ego. And like you said, I think that your distinctions are great. You said the ego petty and the ego proper, correct?
Yeah, the petty ego or the lowercase e ego. If we were writing, it's lowercase e, and the uppercase e ego or the ego proper.
Right, right. And I think that those two distinctions are very important, because when you kind of put it under that framework, you can almost kind of grab a Venn diagram and see where you could toss certain behaviors, certain thought processes, and where they would fit in each. And of course, they would have a certain overlapping theme. But I think that those are more kind of the basics that the ego period needs to survive. You know, it needs awareness of self. It needs awareness of danger. It needs, you know, a lot of these things. But I think people confuse awareness for conscious awareness. You know, awareness is a very, very, very kind of low scale, I want to say, survival mechanism. You know, is it necessary? Absolutely. But I'm saying it's something that kind of all animals really have is a certain low level of awareness of, where am I? Am I safe? Is there food? Can I sleep? You know, things like that. Whereas the ego proper, it sounds to me, would be more kind of like, you know, how is this action going to affect those around me? You know, how can I move in a way where I'm bringing the most good to myself and those that you know, that rely on me? Things of that nature.
Yeah, just higher order thinking, you know. So one of the ways, I guess, that I would look at it, imagine this is a little bit more, not the greatest metaphor, but we're on a higher level than my normal metaphor goes. So imagine you have you ever seen those, like, spectacles from the 1800s that have, like, red lenses and zoom lenses, and there's, like, 100 different lenses on them?
Yes, absolutely.
So let's say the true self is the person wearing the glasses, right?
Yeah.
Most people have just an infinite number of lenses for a bunch of different things. And these are thoughts, beliefs, feelings, ideas, right? So if I belong to a certain political party, then I'm going to have red or blue lenses on, right? If I am, you know, if I am more focused on small details, I'm going to have some zoom lenses on. if I'm more caught up in the big picture, everything's going to be blurry unless I'm looking at stuff that's very far away. Right. So a lot of these things were attached to them. So we've been using the glasses for so long that we don't know we have control over the lenses. Right. And it's the process of self-awareness is when you realize, oh, wow, okay, I can take this lens off and see a little bit more. I can take a couple of these off. But in the process of doing that, you find out that there are some that are built into the frame of the glasses that are just, you can't change these. So if I'm born in America, I'm going to be fairly constrained to my American lenses. Even if I travel the world, there's still that ingrained childhood experience that formed me.
Yep.
Or if I'm, if I'm a man, there are going to be the cultural influences of being a man applied. There's going to be the biological influences of higher testosterone levels. These are going to be part of the ego proper. So that's stuff that you can't change.
Absolutely.
And you're going to have to learn to work around.
Yeah. Gotcha. Gotcha. Now I understand a little bit better in terms of that. And I agree. I think that, you know, one of the biggest things is understanding how perspective works. And I always talk about this on Twitter. I talk about it fairly in some of the episodes, of the podcast, which is people, they marry themselves to their perspective, you know, and they like to assume that because this perspective, and so let's talk about the metaphor that you used. This is somebody who, you know, has the spectacles on, doesn't even know that they can switch it. You know, they kind of just peek through the red and the blue, and so they see the world like that. In my opinion, when you start working through a certain levels of spirituality and you start reaching certain understandings, like you said, you start seeing that you can switch lenses whenever you want. Very much so how the same thing that when shamans, they operate in two different realities. They operate in ordinal reality, which is what you and I on a regular basis operate. And then they also operate from a shamanic point of reality, which means that they're seeing the world through their own kind of ego proper. But at any moment, they can slip into this reality where none of that exists. And in this reality, this journeying reality is where they get their insights. Because I was just talking about that on Twitter. You know, what we see, whether it be through the framework of the glasses or not, limited. Our eyesight is extremely limited. I mean, we only see a fraction of what there is to see in the world if we have the availability to see all types of light and vibration. Our even our ear, which is considered to be a little bit better than our eyesight in terms of the range that it captures, it doesn't capture the full range of hearing. You know, same thing with touch. I mean, we have a pretty good sense of touch in terms of alerting us to danger, but you know, certain animals have the ability to really tell temperature, like down to like degrees. They're able to tell when something is like really, really sharp, and sometimes that kind of supersedes our perceptive ability. So all these senses that we have, that framework built on the ego proper, it's even something that we need to also learn to transcend in a certain sense, even that framework of being an American. And I think that that's the toughest one, transcending that, because it doesn't mean throwing it out. It just means knowing when it's affecting your perspective on things in an objective manner. Because ideally, what we would want to do to be truly our highest self is to even remove, you know, the actual frame of the glasses. But that's the hardest part, you know, because most people think, well, how am I going to be able to see the world without these glasses, period, you know, let alone the blue or the red lens. And I think that's what a lot of people struggle on in a spiritual journey is understanding how they can both be that ego proper or be that mask as closely as they can get it to the higher self and still view things as, you know, I'm a soul. I'm this manifestation of energy. I'm call it whatever you want to call it, but I can always tap into that level of existence. Personally for me, I found that when I go on these shamanic journeys, which again, you know, just to explain, they're really kind of self-induced trances that I've been able to reach after a certain degree of meditation and kind of concentration and self-directed like willpower. But it's really about letting go. And kind of taking off those you know, frames. One of my favorite books or series of books is from Carlos Castañeda. And he has about 8 or 9 books about his experience with a Yaqui shaman, where he talks about one of the first things that you know, that Don Juan, which is the name of the shaman, tells him when Carlos is basically seeking his advice on you know, how to be a shaman, is, you know, Westerners in particular, but most people that don't, that haven't kind of understood shamanism, they look at it as how we see the world, you know, kind of on a regular basis. And so when you read a lot of books by Westerners on shamanism, they'll touch about how, well, you know, shamanism is just a placebo effect. It's kind of seeing the power of the placebo effect and how the mind can change the world around you. And so that's what it is. That's what they've been working on. You know, you explain a placebo effect to a shaman and you tell them that that's all they're working with, and the shaman's going to laugh in your face.
Yeah.
Because, you know, to them, it's a very, very deeply ingrained ritualistic reality that they've created by removing that frame that we speak of, you know, by really being able to look at reality and see how we've been taught that reality works, and to say, well, that's not the only way reality works, because I can see reality in this way. And that kind of leads into why shamans believe dreams are so important, because dreams are a direct result of that, of not looking at reality as it should be, and really just allowing the mind to form, you know, these realities. You know, we're touching on points in even in metaphysics nowadays where they're talking about, you know, if you have a thought, that thought is now a new reality in this universe. It cannot be removed because you thought it up, because your mind has created that. It is now a universe in itself that, you know, has its own rules, has its own regulations, whether or not you set them. And so if you think about it, you could always kind of go back into that universe. If you had a certain daydream that you create, you could always go back into that daydream consciously, and kind of stay within that. And so it's very interesting to see that. And I think that, you know, your idea of the ego petty, the ego proper, and that whole metaphor about the lenses is a great way for somebody who's kind of getting into seeking spirituality to look at it, because it does provide a lot of insight without going so much so into like the more kind of, like you see, you were saying, the Eastern practices of like, oh, kill the ego. Like, yeah, they may be onto something, but it doesn't help for people that may not come from that culture when they read those things, you know?
Right. It's what's really fascinating. I would say that my metaphor is probably useful up until the point that you take the goggles off.
Mm-hmm.
Everything beyond that is comparable to like a psychedelic experience, or, and I think that's probably going to be the way that most people are capable of attaining that state, or even recognizing that they're in that state.
Exactly. Exactly. 100%. And I had a quick debate with somebody about how, you know, psychedelics are definitely helpful. I use them myself. But I think after a certain amount of time where you've been practicing certain things, you can't use it as a crutch, because it's almost like taking off the goggles and then putting on another set of goggles, you know?
That's a good way of putting it.
You get what I'm saying? And it's like, yeah, the psychedelic lets you take it off, but then it's like, if you only believe that it was the drug that got you there and not the realization of what that state means, then you're just putting on another set of goggles, you know? And I agree 100%. Garrett, real quick, I just wanted to kind of direct the attention. Thank you for speaking on that subject. I think that my, you know, listeners are gonna find and have a field day with that, because it's definitely a big topic. But you've written a book recently with I believe it was two other individuals.
Yes.
And I just wanted to, you know, I was wondering if you could just kind of touch briefly on the book, what it is, you know, speak about where my listeners could grab a copy. And also the contributors. The book itself is called, if I'm not mistaken, The Five Pillars of the Ascendant Mind, correct?
Yes.
Awesome.
So the Five Pillars of the Ascendant Mind is the first book published by Ion Media. That's a collaboration, primarily James P. Dowling and Chance Lunsford. They wrote the meat of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then I added stuff. So there's additional stuff before or after chapters where it's relevant that I adapted from my website.
Gotcha.
And I also did, I did the artwork and some kind of introductions to the chapters to frame it in a way with the symbolism that kind of blends it all together. But, so that book you can find on Amazon. We just released the paperback, I think yesterday or the day before.
Awesome. Awesome.
I also put out another book today that's mine by myself. That's Master Self Year One, which is all of the articles I did in the first year of Master Self, which is also available on Amazon in paperback and ebook form.
That's awesome, man. And I definitely recommend to anybody listening, you know, pick up those two books. I myself, you know, I'm still kind of going through your articles that you write, and I think, you know, obviously you're a gifted writer. You know, not only that, but you have an understanding of certain concepts and the way you break them down. It's definitely good for people who are seeking. You know, I think that you have a very philosophical perspective on a lot of things, and I think that philosophy helps people. You know, when you're kind of at a crossroad, you know, it definitely helps to understand the philosophy behind these things, because it kind of gives more meat to okay, which path should I choose? I mean, this makes sense, but this doesn't resonate. You get what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's
sorry, buddy.
Definitely different paths for different people. That's I've done a lot with Gnosticism, alchemy, Zen Buddhism, Hinduism. But fundamentally, mine is, oh man, and they have a word for it in Buddhism, but there's the path of reason. Yeah. So that would be mine. It's everything is, I'm a verbal thinker.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, I've even had like serious high level psychedelic experiences with very little imagery. It's all words. It's all concepts. So that's the means that I can adapt things most accurately. You know, I wouldn't be able to be a visionary artist and go paint a crazy 3D picture or anything. You know, everything for me is, I think, exclusively in words almost entirely.
I feel you, man. I feel you. And I think that you struck on that point very, very greatly. And I touch on this all the time on my podcast, is everybody has a different perspective. Everybody has a different way of doing things. And a big reason why I like to bring in different personalities is so people can see and be like, oh, okay, that person I resonate with really heavily. Maybe I should look into what they were looking into, you know, and I definitely think and agree even with psychedelic experiences. I'm not myself very, very visual. I'm more of like, I just get thoughts, you know,
mm-hmm.
I get like a thought and I'm like, whoa, where'd that come from? That definitely wasn't mine. And then I'll sit there and kind of contemplate it. And then it just becomes this whole series of like conversations with myself in my head. And I'm like, wow, I got so much out of this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I agree 100%. So Garrett, last thing I wanted to touch on, you know, before we end the episode, we have about 10 minutes left. I know that you had written something about nihilism, correct?
Yes.
And so I just wanted to touch on that, because I think that the concept of nihilism itself is a very interesting concept. You know, it's basically kind of the rejection of purpose and the rejection of kind of that we're here for a reason. And that kind of life is meaningless. Am I correct?
Yeah. So that nihilism, basically the premise is that there is no inherent meaning possible in life.
Right.
So to like quickly give you kind of an idea of why it's come up, in this age, like it has,
mm-hmm.
Friedrich Nietzsche was a German philosopher. He's very, very famous. I'm sure your listeners know who he is. He proposed that because of the Age of Enlightenment, because of the advance of all the science and everything, that belief in an external deity was no longer possible. You know, if we know what causes lightning, well, we can't believe in Thor, right, mm-hmm. or Zeus.
Right.
And if the degree to which we became aware of all the science nobody could believe that there's a guy up in the sky deciding people's fates. Right. You know, it was easy when you lived in the 1400s and the Black Plague was happening and, you know, mm-hmm. everyone was dying and you don't know anything about medicine at all,
right.
that you could believe that, like, legitimately, you could have that belief and it wasn't ridiculous at the mm-hmm. time. But because of this science and all of that, that it's impossible for anyone to genuinely believe in an external deity without lying to themselves or believing in some kind of fantasy world where you throw away what we know is true from science.
Right.
And
right.
So you see in the last 100 years, he predicted this like at the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century. And the last 100 years have been people acting this out. So you get hedonism, people just doing things for pleasure.
Right.
You know, the rise of alcoholism and drug abuse is definitely part of that as a way to escape this realization, right?
Right.
You have people who take nihilism and run with it. You know, they're the anti-natalists, so people who say you shouldn't have kids. There are all these different people that deny the fundamental things of life. And mm-hmm. The problem, or the way that we have to overcome this, is we have to find that inner source of meaning. We have to have a direct experience with, if if we want to call it the divine, I would say the true self. But in the terms of the death of God, we have to find the God within.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Understood.
So that's where we're left. You know, yeah. That's what we're left with.
Yep. Yep. And I'm very familiar with, you know, with the concept itself. You know, I've had several debates with people about it. You know, because in, you know, the way that I kind of view the world, and this is particularly from my lens, it's from the shamanic kind of point of view. You know, people look at shamanism and they wonder, well, what is shamanism? They think it's a religion. It's not a religion. Shamanism is a belief system, which can be practiced within any religion. You know, there's shamans mm-hmm. within pretty much Buddhism. There's shamans within Christianity. There's shamans within Catholicism. There's, you know, the belief system doesn't matter. What they believe is that there is an energy that pervades through all things. And so the shaman simply seeks to make communion with that energy. And that energy goes through things that are animate and it goes through things that are inanimate. And so it's very interesting for me to kind of, you know, hear people speak about the concept of nihilism and kind of consider it in my own view. And, you know, I understand why it's on the rise. I think that, you know, a lot of people have given up on religion for obvious reasons. I mean,
oh yeah,
you know, it's you know, you can't turn on the news without seeing something about Christianity or seeing something about Judaism or seeing something about Islam that's painted in a negative way. And you know, I think with our technological superiority right now, and where it's going, I mean, we haven't even cracked the eggshell. I mean, this is going to be within the next 60 years, we're going to have some crazy stuff coming up.
Oh yeah.
It is quick and easy to say, you know, well, there are no deities. There is no this and there is no that. And so the reason I wanted to bring it up is because I wanted to give the kind of shamanic kind of rebuttal to that, which is, it doesn't matter if there is a god or goddess, you know, somewhere kind of controlling the rain or controlling, let's say, not the rain, but the processes of each atom that interacts to create, you know, the grand scheme of what happens when it rains, you know,
mm-hmm.
their belief is more dealing with the energy in it, dealing with the energy of life, dealing with kind of that life force that, you know, whether you believe in God or not, there is a life force present in things. And there are things that don't have that life force. And so that distinction and making that relationship, you know, often it leads one into nature. Why nature? Well, if you look at nature, nature kind of has all the codes for everything kind of inscribed within it. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Every single kind of invention that we've gone out to, and I think I actually tweeted this the other day, is everything we strive to do, nature's already done it. You know,
mm-hmm.
we just seek to almost make it, you know, more easy for us to use, or more refined, or more easy for us to control. But we, you know, even through kind of this technological expansion, we're still always just looking to make technology that nature has already kind of produced, whether it be within animals, whether it be within natural cycles, whether it be, you know, with all these things. It's almost like we're just trying to play catch up with nature, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the points is, you know, I definitely think that, you know, that God within point is important, because we are all divine. You know, we all have this divine spark within us. You know, I don't believe everybody has a soul. That's another conversation for another day.
That is another conversation.
But, you know, we definitely have the divine spark of creation, or else we wouldn't have been created, you know? And so, you know, especially us as humans that do have these kind of abilities to ponder on these things, I think it is our job to, you know, think about, okay, well, if I'm not going to worship a deity, am I going to allow myself to drop down into hedonism? And I say drop down not because I believe that the people who believe in that are at a lower kind of echelon than other people. I say it because the way that I see that, it's almost kind of like a return to a barbaric society where, like, there's no kind of, you know, nothing, you know, you could do whatever and nothing really goes. I mean, as long as there's laws, definitely, obviously, but in terms of your moral standing, it is what it is. I'm only here to live, you know?
Right. I agree with that.
Yeah. And, you know, my theory would be that if everybody was doing that, we wouldn't have much order in the world. You know, in terms of people being able to do what they want to do. If everybody's kind of given free range to just give in to their lower impulses, I mean, you know, in my opinion, that could lead to some problematic issues.
I think we're seeing that happen, honestly.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I think that without having to say how, I think that, you know, a lot of us can see exactly how it's being pushed as well. I think it's definitely something of an agenda nowadays, especially among children. I think they're pushing children into kind of like this belief that you know, that you need to respect people for doing certain things, even if you don't agree with it. While I agree that there is respect to be had for people, I think that respect is earned, and I don't think it's just given out willy-nilly. And I think that, you know, for example, if we're talking about like Maat, right? Even the ancient Egyptians or the people from Kemet, they followed Maat, you know, and they very much were in tune with living in their highest self. They very much were in tune with, you know, honoring who you are in all of its forms, whether it be good or bad. But they also had the undertone of Maat, which is really kind of, you know, these are guidelines that we have to abide by to have a civilized society. You know, I think that if you're a hedonist that lives by yourself in the mountains, hey, all power to you. But if you're trying to get the advantages of a civilized society, there are certain things that you have to be willing to compromise on. And you know, that's a lot of the urges that people may or may not have may not align with that.
Yeah, I agree completely. That was very well said.
I appreciate it, brother. So Garrett, listen, man, I really appreciate your time. I think we had, you know, four or five topics that we touched on that were all very important. You know, I love how you express yourself, man. I think that you have a lot going on for you. I wish you the best of luck with this book that you just released.
Thank you.
The one that you released before. I also wish you luck with Ion Media. I know that, you know, I'm in touch with a lot of you guys in there. I think you guys are all doing great work. You know, definitely some personalities in there that are worth keeping an eye out on. And again, man, I really appreciate you getting on. This is definitely not going to be the last time I have you on an episode. You know, let's connect. Send me the links to your Twitter, to the two books as well, and I'll post them up on the description of the podcast. And then any other information that you want. If I do get any questions from the viewers, I'll send them over to you. We can maybe kind of have like a little catch up on Twitter answering some of these questions if I do get any.
Yeah, I'm down for whatever. I'd love to come back. I would also love to have you on. Either we could do a one-on-one dialogue, or you could come on the Ionosphere at some point.
Definitely.
Oh, I'm gonna hit you up about this at some point, but we definitely need to do that big esoteric Twitter podcast.
Oh, absolutely. I think that would be amazing. I think the people are ready for it. You know, and I think that we have some really bright minds in there, and really good souls in there that would be able to definitely shed some light on their own paths and on how they've gotten to where they've gotten. So definitely let's work on that. Garrett, again, thank you so much for coming. Guys, thank you so much for tuning in to the 23rd episode of Ascension Radio. I know that I've been slacking with the production of the episodes. As some of you guys know, you know, I've been having kind of a little bit of a rough time with the passing away of my grandfather. And so I've been kind of just readjusting to a lot of the things. But I promise you guys that I am going to be dropping all of this information that I have on some of the kind of Andean shamanism techniques that I've been working with. I have a podcast coming up with somebody who is kind of our local expert on the Tree of Life and the Kabbalah. That's an exciting episode as well. And as you just heard, Garrett, we have a couple other podcasts coming from you know, Ion Media that I'm definitely looking forward to participating in. Thanks again for tuning in, guys. Appreciate the love. Ashe.